The Senate General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is Wednesday, September 21st, and we are convened for the purposes of an organizational meeting adopting the committee rules. And then we'll have an informational meeting with invited testimony only on four topics. And I anticipate that we will go in order. And I don't think that with the type of agenda that we have that we will go the entire distance to 11 o'clock, which I'm sure won't break any of your hearts. So that being said, Jan, why don't you tell us where we need to go?
You all have a copy of the Senate rules. These are the model rules. They may look a little different to you from the past because some language was added in Section 6 that just handles situations where you're taking a tour, you're outside of the building, you're on a field trip, and specifying that a recording log does not have to be kept for that. Otherwise, the rules will be what you're familiar with.
Okay. Any questions?
And Mr. Chair, this is just a comment. It's a convenient time to see if everybody else didn't know this the way I didn't know it. But if you ever want a videotaped recording of a hearing, there is only the technological capacity to do a certain number of those when hearings are going on simultaneously. So don't make the mistake that I once made and have a really important hearing that you want preserved in a video archive without checking with legislative media before, because they will arrange to do it, but they won't necessarily do it unless you tell them. So
thank you for that information.
Do you want a motion?
Yes, Senator George.
Mr. Chairman, I move the adoption of the Senate Interim Committee proposed committee rules dated 9/21/2011.
Senator George has moved adoption of the committee rules dated 9/21/2001. Is there discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved. The rules are adopted. At this time, we'll move into the agenda. Could we please bring up Keith Dubanovich of the Department of Justice? Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee. My name is Keith Dubanovich, and I'm Chief of Staff and Special Counsel to the Attorney General. Thank you for the opportunity today to talk about what has been referred to as the MERS issues. But in reality, the legal issues that I'm going to discuss with you today involve many entities other than MERS, so I don't want it to be limited to just MERS. In particular, the issues that I want to talk about involve non-judicial foreclosure, and these issues are being hotly contested today in many court cases around the state, and some of the decisions that are being issued are inconsistent, and there are some consistencies. And to the extent that I can, I will try and educate you on where the courts are in agreement and where there are disagreements. Suffice it to say that this is a very complicated and evolving area of the law, and I look forward to discussing it with you and answering your questions. A little history first. For a long, long time, when people would buy a home, what you essentially would do is sign two pieces of paper. One is a promissory note. You promise to pay X amount of money for your home. And the second would be a deed of trust, which essentially secured the payment of the note. And for a long, long time, these documents would stay with the bank forever and ever until you paid off the loan. Periodically, they might be transferred to another company when a bank would merge, and whenever the loans were transferred, the deed of trust and the note would be transferred at the same time. That was the state of the law and the way things were done for a long, long time in the state of Oregon. Now, historically, there was no requirement in Oregon law that an assignment of a mortgage be recorded. And if you take a look at ORS 86060, it says that mortgages may be assigned by an instrument in writing, and it said that you essentially can, but do not have to, record those assignments. As a consequence, until about 1959, those kind of assignments just simply weren't recorded in order to be foreclosed upon. And I note that that's because most foreclosures up until 1959 took place in a courthouse. So there was an independent judge that would look at the title records and determine who had true ownership interest and whether the loan had been paid, and then authorize the foreclosure process. In 1959, this legislature passed what's called the Trust Deeds Act, and that allowed non-judicial foreclosure, or what's referred to as foreclosure by advertisement and sale. The legislature passed Senate Bill 117 to allow non-judicial foreclosure, but only if the trust deed and any assignments were recorded. The rationale being, if all of these documents were recorded in the county recorder's office, anyone that wanted to determine who owned the property could easily do so. They just simply had to go down to the courthouse and look at the title records. Now, Senate Bill 117 was quite controversial during the 1959 session. For example, the House voted on it four times and finally passed it 31-29. Now, the policy stated at the time in favor of the bill was to, quote, keep up with California, two, to promote banking in the state, and to promote the timber industry, because if we encouraged homeownership, we would encourage more building of homes and promote the housing industry. So Senate Bill 117, which was codified as 86.735, allows foreclosure by advertisement and sale. And that means that essentially you don't have to go to court to do a foreclosure. But subsection 1 is the section that is being hotly contested in the court today. And that is, it states, the trust deed, any assignments of the trust deed by the trustee or the beneficiary, and any appointment of a successor trustee must be recorded in the mortgage records. Now, at no point during the 1959 session was this section controversial. Both banks and citizen advocates agreed that assignments should be recorded before a non-judicial foreclosure. Thus, for over 50 years, Oregon has had non-judicial foreclosure, and during that time, there was never any doubt that all assignments had to be recorded to do a non-judicial foreclosure. Our Court of Appeals has recently said that our Trust Deed Act represents a well-coordinated statutory scheme to protect grantors from the unauthorized foreclosure and sale of property, while at the same time providing creditors with a quick, inefficient remedy against a defaulting grantor. The court further said that due to the legislature's desire to protect the grantor against unauthorized loss of its property, a party conducting judicial foreclosure must demonstrate strict compliance with the act. So that's the history on Oregon law. Now, technology moves fast, and MERS was created in the mid-1990s to facilitate substantial changes in the housing industry, technology, and finance. MERS is the Mortgage Electronic Registration System, and it was created by mortgage bankers around the country with the goal of helping lenders streamline the lending process and eliminate the need to record assignments when selling loans to other mortgage companies. As it became more common for original lenders to bundle the beneficial interest in the loans and to sell them off to investors, the recording process became cumbersome for the mortgage industry, and MERS was essentially created to circumvent the need to prepare and record each mortgage assignment in county land records. Essentially, the MERS system was tailored to avoid local recording requirements, and thus its immediate and practical effect was that lenders who invested in the system stopped publicly recording mortgage assignments. Now, until we had the most recent foreclosure crisis, that wasn't a problem, because if you continued to pay your mortgage for 30 years, nobody ever worried about any of the assignments. By by not recording, essentially what happened is MERS would take the deed of trust in its name or as a nominee. And it was essentially acting on behalf of the beneficial interest in the deed of trust. And by acting as the nominee, these the assignments could take place not in the public record, but in the MERS registration system. And MERS electronically recorded each of these assignments. And during the life of the mortgage, those assignments could be traded dozens of times. So your loan could be sliced and diced and combined with other loans and sold multiple times to other mortgage lenders. Now, in generally, MERS remained the mortgage lien holder in the land, but never held a beneficial interest in the property, meaning that MERS was never owed one penny on the loan. They were just a nominee acting on behalf of the lender. So that's the process that MERS put in place in the mid-90s. And like I said, for a while, everything worked fine until we had the most recent foreclosure crisis. Now, in the process of preparing for today's hearing, I tried to obtain and read every court opinion that has been issued involving MERS in the state of Oregon, and it was a time-consuming process. There are more court decisions than I have time to discuss, so by necessity, I'll generalize what the courts are deciding. Now, these cases arise in a variety of contexts. They arise in homeowner cases brought to enjoin an impending foreclosure. There are cases that come out of bankruptcy court. There are cases brought by homeowners for wrongful foreclosure seeking damages, and there are cases brought by the lenders seeking to evict the homeowner or the former homeowner. Some of these decisions are on temporary restraining orders where the lender does not even appear because the homeowner goes in and says, my foreclosure is going to happen in the next couple of days, and a judge will grant an injunction or a temporary restraining order. So some of these decisions are preliminary in nature, and they are not final. Unfortunately, there have been no Court of Appeals decisions nor any Supreme Court decisions on these issues. There is one case presently pending before the Court of Appeals, but that will probably not be decided for at least another 6 to 8 months, possibly more. So what are the issues that are being litigated? The first is, must all assignments be recorded? According to my computation, there have been at least 7 different judges here in Oregon who have held that if foreclosure by sale is pursued, all prior unrecorded assignments must be filed. And these include State Court Judge Breithaupt, Columbia County Circuit Judge Grant, and U.S. District Court Judges Hogan, Brown, Panner, and King, and U.S. Bankruptcy Court Judge Alley. In essence, these courts have ruled that non-judicial foreclosures are allowed under Oregon law only when the interest of the beneficiary is clearly documented in a public record. Again, going back to the origins of the statute, we will allow non-judicial foreclosure, but only if the public record clearly indicates who has a right to foreclose on the property.
My English is poor, Mr. Chair. Question.
Senator Boquist.
Just to make sure I understand what you're saying. So what you're saying is that if MERS is fine, but if they decide to foreclose on my piece of property, then they've got to go back and record all those documents, then they can go forward?
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist.
That's what you're saying?
That is essentially what the courts are saying, is that if all of these assignments are recorded, you have a perfect right to go through the non-judicial process.
Right.
But if they're not recorded, you need to go over to the court.
So they would go back. Like in my case, they're foreclosing on me, which they're not, just for the public record. They would have to go back, record them, and then go forward with the proceedings. That's kind of what the judges are ruling.
Chair Shields, okay. Senator Boquist, that's correct.
Thanks, I understand.
Now, there, like in any court proceeding, there are other decisions on the other side. And before I get there, let me note one thing, and that is that Judge Panner, U.S. District Court Judge Panner, has said that the requirement under Oregon law that all assignments be recorded is sound public policy. In his decision, he talked about the rationale behind making sure that the whole community could identify who owns the property. That is the origins of our property system, and that's the rationale behind allowing a non-judicial foreclosure, but only if the true ownership, the beneficial ownership, is recorded in the property records. If it's not recorded in the property records, there's no ability of the homeowner or anyone else to identify who truly has the beneficial interest. Now, on the other hand, there's U.S. Magistrate Judge Stewart, who recently issued a decision which is not yet final because she's a magistrate judge. The matter is going up to an Article III U.S. District Court judge. Judge Stewart said that essentially the only assignments that need to be recorded are assignments of the trust deed, differentiating between assignments of the promissory note. She reasoned that under longstanding Oregon law, the trust deed follows the note, and whoever holds the note also has power to foreclose the trust deed without ever recording an assignment of the mortgage. Similarly, Josephine County Judge Newman ruled similar to Judge Stewart that assignments of the promissory note don't need to be recorded, that only transfers of the trust deed need to be recorded. So I can see a question arising from Senator Boquist, and unfortunately, I don't have an answer for you on this.
No, we're hunting geese with number eight shot, meaning, you know, we're just pissing everything off. We don't know an answer.
The reality is that the courts will eventually come to a resolution of this issue about what needs to be recorded and what doesn't. I think it is clear that if there is any assignment of a beneficial interest in the trust deed, that needs to be recorded to do a non-judicial foreclosure. The next issue that is currently being litigated is whether or not MERS in its own right or as nominee has standing or authority to proceed with foreclosures. As I mentioned, MERS is never owed any money on the promissory note. It acts as a nominee or limited agent on behalf of the true beneficiary. A series of judges, including U.S. District Court Judges Jones, Mossman, Hernandez, and Hogan, Magistrate Judges Papik and Stewart, and State Court Judges Breithaupt, Wolke, Newman, and Tickpin, have all said that, yes, indeed, MERS has standing and can be a proper beneficiary under Oregon law to initiate foreclosure proceedings. On the other hand, Judge Panner and Circuit Court Judges Grant and Arnold have ruled that because MERS is not the true beneficiary of the trust deed, it does not have authority to pursue foreclosure proceedings. And last but not least, U.S. District Court Judge Aiken said, I'm not going to address this issue until other courts have tried to define what role MERS really plays as a beneficiary. So Judge Aiken, in two cases, declined to make a ruling on the issue until the case law was further developed and further discovery took place in that case. Two final points. Across the country, a number of county records offices have asserted that MERS should have paid recording fees for all of the assignments, and some county recording offices are bringing suits to collect monies on what they believe should have been recorded assignments. Similarly, a couple of county recording offices are asserting that MERS should now go back and record all assignments so that everyone in the public can properly follow the ownership records of property in the states. Those, for example, arose in North Carolina and in Massachusetts. I am unaware of any legal actions in our state by county recorder's offices. Last but not least, on August 9 of this year, Mr. Cleveland Abbey, on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association, sent a request to the Oregon Law Commission, and he requested that the Oregon Law Commission undertake a project to revise and improve the Oregon Trust Deed Act. Whether or not the commission pursues further examination and study of that act will in part be dependent upon what this body elects to do either in the next session or maybe in 2013. That, I know, is a fairly complicated legal summary, but I'm happy to answer your questions if you have any.
Senator Boquist.
Okay, so let's see. We've taken 20 minutes, and the bottom line is the courts haven't decided clearly.
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, I think that's true on some issues. There is no doubt now that to do a non-judicial foreclosure, the benefit, any assignment of the trust deed clearly has to be recorded. If it has not been recorded or there's any ambiguity in the recording or gaps, you cannot do a non-judicial foreclosure. There still remain doubt about whether beneficial interests, i.e. the promissory note, has to be recorded. I suspect that will be decided within the next year. Whether MERS has standing or not to pursue, I believe the majority of the cases have decided that MERS can, either as nominee or in its own name as a nominee, pursue a foreclosure action. So clarity is coming, but as you well know, it takes time.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Boquist.
Just, I mean, you obviously, this is pure speculation on your part, but as soon as I ask the question, I mean, there'll be stunned silence in the back, and then we'll find out whether your answer is correct or not. So in this portion where, you know, if they're going to foreclose, that they have to go back and file, is pretty much the banking mortgage industry in concurrence with that? Are they complying with that? Or I don't see any, you know, we're not having any testimony from them. So
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, I'm not sure. I think they're, like everyone else, trying to figure out where the lay of the land is before they reach any conclusions about what direction they can go. I know that in some circumstances they've had to resort to the court process simply because they have not been able to establish a clear chain of title, and hence that would require them to go to a judge and present what evidence they have of title. I suspect there's reluctance because of cost and time to go through the judicial process. Although I have understood that the non-judicial process is not as quick as some people would hope either.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And Keith, at the ground level, if somebody, because we get probably hundreds of calls sometimes in a week about our constituents, from our constituents who feel like they're doing everything, they're trying to modify their loans, and they're just not getting any cooperation from the banks or the loan servicers. If they would they have to take, if they say no, I want to contest your ability to foreclose on me, whether or not you have the proper assignments, did they have to proactively then go to court to assert that dispute?
Chair Shields, the answer is yes. Essentially, there's no forum other than in a court proceeding to be able to challenge who has authority to pursue a foreclosure. And that's why I said at the outset that these issues arise in a variety of contexts. Some come up in a bankruptcy context where the homeowner feels like they're at end's wits and they need to do something, so they file for bankruptcy. And in that context, the parties debate who actually has proper title to foreclose on the property. Some of them are actions initially brought by the homeowner to enjoin a foreclosure. And some of them are brought after a foreclosure has actually taken place, at which point the homeowner says, I don't think they actually had proper authority to pursue the foreclosure. So the cases are being brought by homeowners, and I suspect that, unfortunately, because the non-judicial process does not provide them much of an opportunity to contest that proper title, that we're going to continue to see a large number of cases in our courts.
Okay. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keith, I have a couple of questions, if that's all right with the Chair.
Yes.
We had hearings on this issue in the previous session, and what I wanted to ask you about is whether you looked at actually the accuracy of the MERS database itself. it's my understanding that about 60% of the transactions in the country are through MERS. And I, at one point, found some of the language that appears in the MERS agreement with the lenders, where it says MERS makes no representations or warranties regarding the accuracy or reliability of the information provided. MERS disclaims responsibility or liability for errors, omissions, and the accuracy of any information provided. So I'm a little concerned about whether you've looked at and have an opinion about the accuracy of the database itself. Who's responsible for that? You know, with our recording system, we have accountability at each county office. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Chair Shields, Senator Bonamici, as you may have heard, there is a multi-state investigation into the mortgage industry. It's initiated as a result of what was called the robo-signing, or filing of affidavits that were false. Because that investigation continues, I cannot comment on what we may or may not be looking at, but suffice it to say that we have great concerns about any representations that are not accurate and factual and truthful.
And I have a follow-up. And Keith, you mentioned that there haven't been any Court of Appeals opinions or Supreme Court opinions in Oregon. Have there been in other states where they have a similar trustee statute that's being interpreted?
Chair Shields, Senator Bonamici, yes, there have been a number of court decisions across the country, and unfortunately, I was the victim of having to read a couple of law review articles last night on this topic. This is an area that is hotly contested and hotly litigated, and there is a split of authority in these decisions. There are a number of cases that say that MERS cannot proceed with a foreclosure. There are some decisions that say they can. And because property recording and foreclosure laws are unique on a state-by-state basis, I don't think it's accurate or fair for us to simply decide that if Georgia says MERS can't or North Carolina says MERS can, that that would be appropriate ruling in our court. It would be something that we ought to pay attention to, but it's not controlling authority.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keith, sometimes I feel like in these crisis situations, we are like wandered into a forest and we can't really see whether it's trees or forests. So I want to back up a little bit and let's take ourselves out of the idea that we're in the middle of a crisis. Originally, policymakers allow these types of things to happen because they wanted the ease of credit to consumers who may not otherwise be able to access homes. That was the policy decision. I think the decision makers made at both state and federal level to try to create this and make the ease of transaction and the ease of financing and ease of capital to flow into the housing markets. Now that's blown up in our face. So looking back, if you could go back 15 years, talk to me about the policy way you would set this up to both accommodate the goal of allowing capital to access into these markets that might not otherwise be served so people could actually buy homes versus what's happened. Do you see what I'm saying? Because it seems like to me that we're really critical of MERS and the banks and the mortgage board. Really, a lot of the stuff was done by policymakers. I mean, people sitting at the dais saying, hey, my constituents are saying they don't have access to capital. So we're trying to do both. What we want to do is take credit for giving capital to people who otherwise wouldn't deserve it, and then we're blaming people because they actually did what we as policymakers asked them to do. So now you've got this facility, MERS. I'm trying to figure out what is the proper, throughout what we know, what would be the proper mechanism for this organization to go forward from a policy perspective, still allowing people to access capital fairly easily?
Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, good question. I tried to set this up with the context of the historical perspective of land title recording in the state and the fact that MERS was created because the perception was that land title recording was cumbersome, expensive, and just generally slow. It's still true in many county recorders' offices that you have very difficult access to property records. They're generally or oftentimes on paper. Well, MERS is an electronic system. And the reality is that MERS facilitated the flow of capital to borrowers, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. If I had a magic wand, it would be to ensure that our recording offices have the same kind of technology that MERS does, because then everyone in the public has immediate access to property records. We wouldn't be in a situation of not recording everything, because things would be recorded down at the county recorder's office. And at the same time, because of the speed of electronics and electronic filing, the industry wouldn't be hamstrung and feel like they're challenged in having to slowly record everything on paper. So unfortunately, what we had is a confluence of an antiquated property recording system, substantial advancements in technology that far surpassed what we had been doing in county recorder's offices, and a substantial advancement in finance. And the three simply, unfortunately, crashed at the same time. And I think what we need to do is take a step back, as you suggested, and try and figure out how can we fix this problem going forward so that all three can work together.
Follow up.
I guess, Keith, here's what I'm trying to get at. I'm really confused exactly what the problem is here, because we clearly have a crisis. So is the problem that people have with MERS right now this idea that I can't go find out who the ultimate person is? Because then it seems like to me it'd be fairly easy. You basically, for each piece of property, have the county set up an electronic filing, and MERS would just update it. And I think what the counties want is every time they electronically update it, then they get 10 or 15 or 20 bucks. I mean, if this is a money thing, then we need to say it's a money thing. The counties want additional dollars to have these electronic registries happen. We're not going to give them the money at the counties to put in electronic systems. We're just not. We don't have the money, and they don't have the money, so it's not going to happen. So the question is it access to the information that people have a problem with? Because I'm trying to decide from the policy perspective, is it smart for us to, in essence, slow down the movement of capital behind the recording? I mean, what happens is if we start interfering in this because we're worried about the public information, we could actually slow down the capital movement, which would actually really hurt housing recovery. So we may be making the policy worse by not really identifying what the true problem is. If it's just transparency, then we need to say it's just transparency. If somebody has another problem where they don't like the movement of capital, then I would like to know that's the problem. So you see what I'm getting at?
Yeah, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, it's my impression there are obviously multiple concerns, and they come from all different sectors. I mean, one is the cost and time of going through the foreclosure process. And if you're in an industry that's trying to expedite the sale of homes and a home gets stuck in the foreclosure process for 18 months, that's not good for your industry. From a homeowner's perspective, you know, wanting to make sure that whoever is going to pursue the foreclosure actually has proper authority to do so is pretty darn important. And that's a bedrock principle of our law since the beginning of time. And the lack of transparency has led to a lot of fear and paranoia in the public about who really is the rightful owner to my property and who really has authority to foreclose. You know, you may be right that if we simply facilitated re-recording or recording in the first instance of every assignment down at the county recorder's office, and then they went through the foreclosure process non-judicial, at least we did advance transparency, and I think it would reduce some of the fears in the community.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Keith, when I look at this situation and I say, how are we trying to fix this? I'm trying to view it from the public policy perspective. And I have a lot of constituents who are in foreclosure and they're very frustrated. At the end of the day, what really happened out there was people borrowed money that they couldn't pay back. And so now what you have is you have a group of people who are, and I would say that a mortgage broker gave me a loan that was probably wholly inappropriate based on the situation. I mean, we all did it. It was easy money. We get into houses that we probably shouldn't have wisely done. But we all saw real estate going up and up and up, and we all believed in the bubble. So, I mean, there's some culpability on consumer side. So now what's happened is that you have the promissory note, and if I fail to make my mortgage payment, then clearly somebody has the right to foreclose. Clearly somebody does, because I've broken my agreement. I'm not paying my mortgage. So is the question at the consumer level that you guys are hearing, is this truly trying to figure out who I talk to, or is this an attempt to slow down the foreclosure so I can live in a house for longer that I'm not paying mortgage payments on? I mean, if there's truly people who are saying, hey, there's a problem with my mortgage and I can make my mortgage and I can stay in this house, I'm all in favor of trying to make the public policy decision to give them the right to be able to negotiate and work on that. If this is people just trying to game the system to stretch out how long they can stay in a house for free, then I'm not sure that's a smart public policy perspective, because every homeowner around them is then negatively affected by that action. So what I want to do is help the people who truly have a chance of staying in their home. I'm not in the business of trying to create public policy just to allow people to continue to have the real estate market spiral out of control. So who are we trying to help and why?
Was that a question?
Well,
or a speech?
Mr. Chair, I'm really confused. I've sat through
could,
now.
You could have put your testimony in writing.
My problem is I sit here and I listen to this and I'm trying to figure out exactly, everybody's mad at the financial institutions. Well, okay. But at the end of the day, what are we trying to fix? Are we trying to fix the problem for who and why? And it seems like to me that's the core question before we discuss any of these issues. And I'm not sure from the AG's perspective, where is the problem? Where is the, in essence, consumer damage? I want to help consumers who are doing the responsible thing. I don't necessarily want to help consumers who are just gaming the system.
Chair Shields, Senator George, I'll try and answer that if I can figure out what the question was. As the Attorney General and the Department of Justice look at this, we have a responsibility to make sure that Oregon law is complied with under any circumstances, whether someone has been in their home for 20 years on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage and paid every single month, or somebody took an extraordinarily expensive balloon payment. It doesn't matter. Oregon law is Oregon law, and we have an obligation to make sure it's complied with. So that's our number one driving principle. The second is to ensure that there's full transparency in whatever takes place. And whether somebody's trying to game the system by taking too big of a loan or staying in their home too long, or they're trying to revise their mortgage to stay in their home for a little bit longer because they think that they're going to get a job in 6 months, the fact of the matter is that if there's better transparency and full compliance with the law, I think the system will work the way it was intended to work. And that's our driving motivation.
Thank you.
And if I could add, I mean, noting those problems, you still have an obligation to record things in the proper way. And I think that we should try to get back to a system where we have some assurance that that proper recordation was actually happening and is happening moving forward. Senator Rosema.
Thank you. Chairman Shields, and I will just make a brief comment and then I do have a question. I think my historical perspective on this doesn't go back as far as some people's on this committee apparently, but I still remember sitting just down the hall in 2007 in hearings like this talking about what to do about a pending foreclosure crisis in Oregon and hearing witness after witness get up and say, you should do nothing because we don't really have a foreclosure crisis in Oregon. It's in Arizona and a whole bunch of other states, and here things are pretty good. And then I remember 2 years later sitting here with Senator Bonamici chairing a similar committee to this, trying to figure out what should we do to make things better, because by then everybody had acknowledged that it had caught up with Oregon. So I guess my question to you is the same one that I posed to someone I don't see in the room but was a representative of the banking industry, which is just today, if you or a member of your family was faced with a pending foreclosure, what's the best advice that you would give them? And this person, who was not a lawyer, said they should get a really good lawyer, which was sort of painful advice when we'd just been sitting there hearing that there weren't enough lawyers willing to take these cases or places for people to go. But I think that is one threshold question, because this is really way more complicated than the average person can begin to sort out. They don't know the difference between a promissory note and a deed. They just know, what do they do right now so they can stay in their house or get out of it and try to figure out how to find some rental property, which increasingly people can't afford either. So do you have any sort of common sense advice like that?
Chair Shields, Senator Rosenbaum, that is a good recommendation to get an attorney. But the reality is, if you're facing foreclosure, you don't have money to hire an attorney. And people in Oregon are facing just horrible circumstances. To be kicked out of your home, in many circumstances, you've been in the home for a dozen years or more and raised your children there. That is an emotionally difficult time for people. And so the first thing for them to do is to try and find a housing counselor. The Housing and Urban Development Department has a list of free housing counselors. Those people know how to facilitate a loan modification, make an assessment of whether somebody's eligible for a loan modification, and it may be that they're not, but at least they can then start planning for the process of leaving their home. But if they may qualify for a loan modification, ask for a loan modification. There are some tremendous programs out there, both within the state of Oregon, sponsored by the state of Oregon, the Oregon Housing and Community Services. The federal government has loan modification programs, and most of the major financial institutions have loan modification programs. It does not hurt to ask. Next, keep very good paperwork. Every time someone talks to a loan servicer, take a note of who you spoke to, get their name, and identify what you spoke about, and take notes about that, because it may very well become extremely important later on down the road. When you receive a notice in the mail, don't throw it away. Unfortunately, a number of consumers have a perception that if they don't read something, they don't look at it, it won't hurt them. But that's not true. They actually need to grab the notice in the mail, hold on to it, talk to their loan modification counselor or their housing counselor, and pay attention to what's being asked in it. Don't ignore what is being requested. Unfortunately, from time to time, people may apply for a loan modification before they get a notice of foreclosure, and the notice of foreclosure says, do you want a loan modification? And they think they're already in the process, so they don't respond. Well, unfortunately, we've heard of servicers that get the response back saying that the homeowner doesn't want a loan modification, and then the foreclosure proceeds ahead. So it's a complicated process, one that is fraught with peril, but it's an extremely important process. And if someone can't find a housing counselor, go to a neighbor, go to your pastor, but seek help, because there is help available out there.
Okay. Senator Boquist, and then we're going to move on.
Oh, great. Thanks. I mean, Senator George raised some really good points. And, you know, we've listened to this throughout the previous full session, and now we're here. And to me, it kind of, because of what Senator George says, and I saw the same position before, this really boils down to transparency. And the reason being is, you know, from a policy perspective, you know, whatever we do is ensure there's transparency to establish the facts. And the reason being is the facts are all different. I mean, there is no easy capital anymore. There won't be any easy capital in the Western world. It's over. Financial markets are going to continue to collapse because they have to right size. I mean, it's just the way life is. Government borrowed money, it can't repay. We have banks sitting in the state of Oregon right now that if they could charge forward and clean their books off and do their foreclosures, the FDIC and the Treasury would close them down tomorrow. So they're dragging their feet, kicking and screaming, and not doing any foreclosures. And then we have banks on the opposite side that are racing forward to clean their books up. And then we have people like Senator George, I'm in my district too, who went out and borrowed $1 million to build something and they made $2,300 a month. And so their course in the deal trend, it's all over the place. There's a dozen different reasons that we're in a free fall financial collapse. And each of them, as we just heard here, and I made the analogy, we're hunting geese with number 8 shot, because you got 25, 30, 40 court cases out there, and they're all different because they all have a little bit different perspective, but the only commonality is, okay, the judge has got to figure out the facts in each one of them. So to me, we do anything in this area, it just comes down to transparency, because we can't fix the people who should never have borrowed. We can't fix the banks that, you know, if they foreclose on all of them, there's at least a half dozen in the state of Oregon, they'll go under tomorrow. It's too complex from a policy point of view. I mean, to me, again, it boils down to us. I mean, whatever we can do to help transparency so we can unsort it piece by piece, which is going to be a painful, ugly process.
Right.
That's what we need to do.
And lay the foundation for a better tomorrow on this.
Yeah, it might be 1959 tomorrow, too, by the way.
But I think the one thing that we are hearing is we need to be very cautious in how we proceed. So with that, I will thank the Chief of Staff of the Department of Justice, Keith Dubanovich, for his testimony. And we will now move into the second agenda item on indefinite quantity contracts. Could we please bring up Vijay Deodor and Rob Bruce, and then why don't we bring Clyde up as well?
You're not going to fight among themselves, are they?
Nope.
Okay.
They've been working together.
I just remember the last hearing. Oh,
you can sit at
So, colleagues, to tee this up, Senate Bill 667 was a bill related to indefinite quantity contracts that small engineering and drafting companies have brought forward to us how to improve that process at the state level. And we passed the bill through the Senate and didn't make it all the way through the House. And I wanted to just get an update from the parties that have been working on finding common ground on the topic. And so I think what we will do is we'll start off with you, Vijay, and you can kind of lay out,
sure.
Remind us of the problem statement, and then tell us a little bit about what's happened since.
Certainly. Well, thank you, Chair Senator Shields. Thank you, Vice Chair Senator George and the distinguished panel. Good morning. I'm Vijay Deodar. I own a business since 2002. I'm an architect by training and license, but no longer practicing as an architect. My business is in CAD drawing services and architectural engineering support services, but this issue goes to my heart because basically the issue is same for whether architect, engineers, or technical service providers in the state. I also belong to Oregon Association of Minority Entrepreneurs, and we have an architectural engineering committee, which I'm unofficially kind of representing here, and we have in this small 800-member organization, we have about five of us. We are in the room here. You may want to raise your hands just to show who you are. And that kind of, you know, explains what the passion behind this whole issue is and how it is hurting and what we can do about it. We are basically, let me explain the background of this issue. The background is simple. If there is, from public contracting point of view, there is this roster, as that sometimes referred to many different expressions, either IDIQ, which is indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contract in federal terms, or sometimes in state level, it is called on-call service agreements. So the idea behind that is to procure services from these technical service providers as and when they need, even though the need may not necessarily be kind of, you know, clearly distinguished, expressed. But over and over, we all the members, or many of us would agree, the frustration here is that the agencies that include state, county, city, jurisdictions, and quasi-government, school, college, university districts, everywhere pretty much the problem is same, that these requests for proposals or requests for qualifications are kind of asked for responses from number of respondents like us, small business owners, and we don't get to see any work out of that. So it is something which jokingly I said that, but that's appropriately kind of explains the issue, is like having a fishing license, but there's no fish to there's no pond to fish. And that adds tremendous frustration to small business community. In fact, if we look at Oregon, when we talk about small business, small definition of small business in Oregon state, which is 100, but if you ask the small business development centers or any of these organizations how much your clientele is, which is beyond 25 employees in a firm, and majority of them are actually 25 or under, and we are talking about really micro-level businesses, not even small businesses, which is what it is hurting. And those are the businesses which are adding, for instance, to give you a good news in this, is that my small business has added 6 jobs in just last 6 months alone. So I'm very proud of that, but not that every time it's that simple or easy. So having said that, what is the core issue of this whole discussion here? And last time around, we came to this hearing. The core issue is the frustration among small business owners who do see these RFPs. They spend tremendous amount of their resource marketing dollars, which we have practically done many times. In fact, all five of us who are here today, we are losing almost days' worth of work. So you can imagine how much it adds to our expenses with no guarantee of any work at all. So that's a burden. Second other thing is that in this request for proposals or the price agreements or whatever that you make all the different names to it, there are half a dozen or sometimes 10 or sometimes 20, 30 vendors are selected for services, which in reality there may be very little or no work. Second other thing is if there is work, then, you know, only the first two or three or maybe one or two people would get the contract. Rest of them will not get anything out of it. So that's another thing which, you know, it's a rotation issue of giving, making sure that everybody, at least those who are selected, get some piece of the work. So that's this, that's one of the concerns also. But the other thing is, in our view, our point of view is that there's a cost for being ready. And so therefore, this bill or our request is that in federal government contracting procedures, not all agencies, but, you know, ODOT perhaps can speak more in detail about it. But our knowledge or our understanding is that certain federal agencies, if you are on the IDIQ contract selected, then if you don't get any work out of that within that stipulated period of time, you may get certain percentage either not as a free money, but as a small work order just to compensate you for your efforts that you put in. And this is not what we see in the state level or any other local jurisdictional level. That adds more frustration to the whole issue. The other thing is also, when does the actual contract begin? If it's a three-year period contract, and if small business owners get, suppose if at all, if ever they get any work, if they get the work in the last month of the contract, then they're done. I mean, you know, so our suggestion here is that if you are on the that panel of selected vendors, and if you get the work, then your three-year term should really begin when you actually got the work, as opposed to when as opposed to just finishing by the timeline. So, to summarize this whole issue, I think, you know, we understand that other agencies, including ODOT, may have concerns. We are willing to work with them, you know, on this issue. The issue is not just simply from small business point of view, but if you look at it as a citizen and as a community member in the small business community, if you look at it, where the government is spending, we have so many different counties and so many different state agencies and so many different jurisdictions, public jurisdictions or quasi-government. If they are spending that much time internally to kind of float these RFPs, how much time is being spent? Because especially in today's economy, they get hundreds of responses. So to review those responses and to select that process, there is some time that's needed on agencies' part as well. So the question is to reduce that level of effort on the government side to spend, to save some money on that, but also equally equally strong or equally important, as I explained earlier, is the issue of, you know, reducing this frustration and streamlining the issue. So that's what my comment will be.
Great. I think you teed that up very well. Why don't we go on to Rob Bruce, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Shields and members of the committee. Thanks for having us here today. BJ said it real well.
Just as a formality, could you identify yourself for the record for the recording?
Rob Bruce, VP of Business Development, Sandy River Construction Services. Our firm does provide professional services to government agencies as well as estimating consulting services to small to medium-sized construction companies. One thing I can say is, going to start out, I want to put some dollars to what BJ said. But about 6 or 8 months ago, I made the decision in our company to simply not go after these RFPs anymore that are the IDIQ type. It's ridiculous. As a small company, put some dollars to it. If it costs us about $3,000 to put out a response to an RFP, if we do five of those per year, that's pretty simple math. In a small company, that can be a decision: do we have health care or do we not? Do we hire another employee or do we not? Do we branch out into a different type of work or we don't? From the government side, I really don't have absolute true numbers, but I've been doing this for a long time. I can't see that it costs the government any less than probably $10,000, and I think that's a very conservative number, to submit an RFP. So you take 10 agencies, they submit five of these RFPs that no work come out of. Each one of them submits five RFPs. There really no work is ever developed from. There's no benefit to the government. There's no benefit to the public. There's no benefit to small business. If it costs them $10,000, a conservative number, again, easy math, I'll let you run it. So it's just not serving anybody. I'd like to tag SD 667, the common sense bill. You know, we just heard a lot about MERS and how things aren't done right, and that was very interesting. Let's stop this one where it's at and clean this up. The public doesn't deserve it, small business doesn't deserve it, and government doesn't deserve it. We all need to spend our money wisely. Thank you.
One thing that I'm concerned about in this as well is that if a government entity is using this IDIQ process, the possibility that then they could favor one particular firm without a full public RFP and disclosure process. So, you know, one of the things we try to do around here is not put people's hand in the cookie jar, right? And if we have a system set up that allows people to do this without much oversight, they could be in a position where they have a relationship with a particular person who has received one of these, and then they say, you know, this guy's done good work, buys me Blazer tickets, maybe I'll just keep giving him the work, and giving some temptation that frankly should not be there from the public contracting side. Would any of you like to comment on that?
Well, again, I do not have the numbers to substantiate my comment here. It's a conjectural kind of comment. But as a small business owner, it is very hard to, in fact, find out what exactly happens beyond which, where, you know, you get selected, and then how do people on that selected panel, do they get the work? The perception is that those who are either influential or big, or those who have more money to market themselves, have a reason to kind of get more work, of course. And the question is, again, goes back to how do we grow small businesses, those who are mushrooming or those who are doing well, and support them in the fair way. So I don't have, Senator, that answer for you in exact terms, is whether that is exactly followed in a certain way or not. And again, if it is followed, whether it is followed across the board by all agencies the same way, that also I do not know for sure.
Go ahead, follow.
Vijay, you bring up something really interesting here. So you guys submit a bid to do this kind of work at this price if it comes up. When you go in, you don't know exactly how much work there's going to be, correct? And then once the work is actually...
Maybe let me correct that before we go further, if it's okay with you.
Sure, no.
It's not a bid. Typically, these are requests for qualifications or proposal. In technical services arena, as opposed to construction, these are not bids. These are all basically requests for qualifications. It's a pre-qualification process. So essentially, based on your qualifications, your experience, your references, and everything, and sometimes certain agencies do even ask for your price rates or price structures, or rate structures, in other words. But beyond which, it is nothing. There is no actual work. However, having said that, there is this hope that there is a work, and we expect that since the RFP is out on the street, which means government has some work for us to do. And this is where the core issue is, that many of these agencies do not have any work for some of those disciplines. And so this is like a teasing, right? You know. And so that you have this warm and fuzzy feeling that you have this project coming in the next 3 years. You're going to line up a few more, but there's nothing out there. I mean, certain agencies which I can think of, even including in my own business, more than 6 years, like three times we have submitted the proposal, and we didn't earn a dime's worth of work in those contracts, or agreements, I should say.
But you answered half my question, so that's really interesting. So let's say, for instance, there is work that's poured in the top of this thing, and you have 10 firms. Let's say there's multiple options. There's no transparency on how which firm of the 10 that's been pre-approved or pre-qualified. Is there no transparency on how that firm that actually has awarded the business got the business? Is there then a bid process after that? So you pre-qualify and then there's a bid process, or you pre-qualify and then the agency just picks off that list?
They do just pick. You submit. The ones we used to go after, usually you do have to provide, say, your price list for this level of consulting or this service, how much is it? Then they're weighted. So your experience is given so many points, your price is given so many points, references are given so many points. So then they score the proposals. If they're going to pick three, then if you end up in the top three, then you may or may not get work. The transparency that is there is that you can go in and ask for a review. If you did not get the work, and I've done that a few times, and agencies, you're usually very open about that, and you sit down with them and they show you some of the other scoring, maybe. Sometimes they don't. They'll discuss with you why you were not chosen.
Thank you, guys.
Senator Boquist.
We heard this last session, and actually it came out of the committee unanimously, I think. Even Senator George voted on it. These IDIQ contracts, I think for the record, you know, and obviously Department of Transportation has been working with these folks, but it is a statewide problem. And you get into this, and it's really IDIQ is like a junior GSA list, General Services Administration bid list. The agency generally puts out the IDIQ and says, we think we're going to spend $1 million on XYZ. And so these companies go out and they file for the IDIQ. Now, under federal law, and we discussed this previously in the committee hearing before, is under federal law, they have to issue a minimum. So 10 firms will come into the IDIQ and say, agency X, Department of Education, I'm not beating them up, no, just for sake, Department of Education issues this IDIQ for personnel services for maybe $1 million. There's 10 people that come in, they award three contracts to them, and then the problem comes down is that the three contracts that are there, then, you know, they kind of pick and choose. Now, on the federal government side, when we talked about this committee, there's a minimum. You got awarded, you're going to get a minimum award out of this $1 million if the $1 million comes, if the legislature approves, so on and so forth. My experience with these, and I have a lot of experience with these at the federal level, is that first off, the notion that there's competition is total BS. Total BS. Because the RFP for the IDIQ that's put together is based on some work somebody else done. Nobody does anything original, okay? So therefore, they know, for example, Kevin out there does this work, so we take his old contract, we make the structure up like that, and then we farm it out, and we keep farming the bloody thing out until we get 10 or 15 people of these people to come in, and now we got a broad enough selection with enough criteria, we can pick the three people we want to do it anyway. And so they kind of pick those three people that they're going to do it, and then they award the contract to them, you know, so they go. Now, review process is exactly correct. The agency would be very happy, you know, any one of the agencies to come in and do it, so on and so forth. But I'll friggin' guarantee you that, you know, once you ask that review, you're never going to get a contract from that agency. You're blackballed. You know, and so, you know, the problem we had with the last bill is that, you know, it kind of addressed some of these issues, but it really needs to do is address in a statewide issue, a GSA type of listening, General Service Administration type listening that says if Bob out there comes in, applies his, or Rob applies, puts it in there, and he meets these qualifications for this service, he's good for the state. So therefore, and he was on the Department of Transportation contract, but if DOE needs the same services, then they can pull him off of that and move it across. That's perfectly legal under federal law, and that's what really needs to happen in the state, because you got 25 agencies asking for these things, generating work that is BS to start with, and these guys are applying for it. It would save a ton of money. Now, obviously, we can't go to the federal side because it's too difficult to say, okay, if they're on the GSA list, the state of Oregon law has passed that says we recognize the GSA list. There are many states that have that. I think the Attorney General could check on that and find out that there are states that recognize the General Services Administration schedule, and it's adopted into their own laws so that if they're on a federal GSA schedule, that they don't go out and competitively bid it. If they need, you know, Bob to go do work, they can do something like that. That was the failing of the last bill that we had. We kind of addressed to the bottom, but it didn't do all the way across the border. Because we're back to the previous testimonies where we're broke, we can't afford to be doing this six times, and we need to have a central listing, which actually Department of Administration, Department of Transportation are doing a pretty good job. Amazing.
Thank you.
crediting these people, that they're doing a pretty good job of trying to consolidate that and make a list and say, here's the central list. Mm-hmm. So if these guys have these services, you don't go do a new RFP. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this whole competition thing just slays me because it's not true at all. Not true at all. I mean, we had, DOT was here when we raked them over the coals on their top 10 contractors last year. Now, this is all. But we've got to get, we're back to transparency, do it once for a statewide system, and, you know, whatever one department does, it's good for the other department and it saves money.
That's a good point. And going to Senator Boquist's discussion around this, again, the cost of being ready includes fairly significant annual premium in bonding insurance. And are those, in your experience, are those uniform across most agencies or municipal or the bonding requirements?
It's a mixed bag, Senator. In certain cases, they will expect you to be fully ready. In some cases, they may not. But again, there's no uniformity in that at all.
Mm-hmm. And But
the fact still remains is that you have this kind of a great expectation that, you know, since the very fact that you're selected, which says that, you know, there is some work. Mm-hmm. And if it happens once in a while, you understand that, you know, it's not guaranteed anyway. It's just a pre-qualification process. But when this happens consistently over a certain lot many years period of time, then it's a systemic problem. It's not a problem with just, you know, one agency or one item or anything. It's just a problem that needs to be fixed.
Mm-hmm. Good. Clyde, would you like to kind of fill us in on the process of all of you working together?
Senator Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, first of all, I want to thank Senator Boquist for the recognition and acknowledgement. Appreciate that. Just a couple of comments. I did provide you with some written testimony. We have been working with OAMI and Mr. Diodor and Mr. Kadri on this issue. I think one of the things, Senator Boquist really hit on an important point. It's been difficult for us because when we have these discussions, we can only speak for ODOT. And part of the frustration, I think, is that without some sort of a statewide framework, they're having to go to each agency, and each agency has a little bit of a different process, a little bit of a different requirement. So at least from the state side, looking at something at a statewide level, I think makes a lot of sense and will increase efficiency and make it less frustrating for contractors. What we have been working really hard on within the Department of Transportation is when we go to these price agreements, we impose a secondary solicitation process. So it's not that you can just pick somebody off the list. As you put a work order out, you have to do a secondary solicitation that's graded just like all our other solicitations. So everybody gets to bid on that piece of work instead of just picking somebody off the list. As always, you know, we can improve it. And when we have some issues, we're Mr. Diodor and Mr. Kadri are quick to call us, and we sit down and try to work those issues out with them. The other thing I'd like to say is that we will have some issues we need to work through with our federal partners and with legal counsel out of the Department of Justice. I don't think they're insurmountable. I think it's just really getting down, negotiating, and having some discussion, and we can kind of work through those to get to where we need to get to. But I think if I will make any point today, and to me this is the most important point, is that we have to bring other state agencies and local governmental entities to the table because it's got to be a broader discussion. It's, again, if it's just a discussion with the Department of Transportation, then it fixes whatever issue they have with us. But then they're dealing with the other state agencies and other public entities that fall under ORS 279. So it really has to be a broader discussion.
Right. And your point's very well taken. We had a meeting on this topic yesterday, and I'm glad to see so many of the other stakeholders here. What I'd like to do in the next couple of weeks is get the various municipalities, cities, counties, special districts, anyone else who might have some concerns of how this might go down, and make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences of this legislation, that we can come up with a product that everybody can be comfortable with. Senator Boquist.
I think because he raises this point here, because we have so many federal matching funds, and even though they're going to decline in massive quantities over the next couple of years. There's still going to be the regulatory framework, and that's why if it's some sort of GSA schedule type framework that could be developed, you know, in the state, that, you know, that then gives the cities, the counties, and the districts, doesn't force feed them, but says, hey, if you use this system, you're covered legally, mm-hmm. right? And then that type of system, of course, is recognized by the federal level. I mean, the ability to downsize gradually and efficiently to save money, carefully wording here, so that, you know, when our procurement system 18 months from now, when you need an architect, there's a central architect list. We already have a central list that lists the vendors. We already have this. This technology is already there through DAS. Mm-hmm. We list the vendors. They're on there. But we don't have the second step, which says, and here's the approved rates or here's the approved parameters that you can get them with. And here's the parameters that meet the federal competitive requirements, which are BS anyway, no disrespect, Keith. But, you know, that gives us something to work with, because that will save a tremendous amount of money over the next 18 months to 3 to 4 years as we downsize.
Mm-hmm. Good points. Anything else?
If I may add, I think just one last comment. I think thank you, Senator Berkquist, for, you know, I mean, your frustration is it goes to my heart. I mean, in fact, that's what is basically happening, and we really need to fix this. In my point of view, as a just an ordinary guy, you know, whether the money comes from city's pocket or the county's pocket or the state's pockets, it's public money. So, you know, the concern should be, you know, the same all across the public entities, that how we can improve this process and, you know, save the money not only for the vendors and the architects, engineers, but also for the public entities. Mm-hmm. So we are willing to, as I earlier expressed, we're willing to work with I mean, ODOT has been tremendous help, by the way, and they have come up a big way. I mean, I appreciate their help compared to many other agencies. Our experience has been quite encouraging. Yes, there's a long way to go, but we will work with this.
Good. And so I think our plan, and is for those of you who are in the audience who have an interest in the topic and want to make sure it's done right, I'll probably have Jan pull together a work group meeting in mid-October, is what we talked about last night. And I also want to thank Joanne from ODOT for doing some very good research that she presented at the meeting that we had last night. And one of the things that I found very interesting is that some federal agencies provide a modest stipend for that cost for readiness that could help, you know, pay for the bonding premium. And she indicated that stipend can be something, you know, modest but significant for a small business, $500. But yet some agencies, like the highway department, have concerns because they don't do that, and they so we're going to have to figure out what's legal and what's not and how we can proceed. But I think you know, it's very important for government to not only save money and do this the right way, but also we should be in our best days here to help, not to hinder the development of small business.
One last comment, Senator Shields. In terms of working through this together, since we are all in this together, from agency as well as vendor community, what we are suggesting also is that, you know, any agency such as the federal agency or somebody, some certain other agency, has issues with this type of contracting because of the legalities or something, we may want to exclude that with the certain language in the bill, so that, you know, we don't kind of, you know, suffer because of that hold up, I mean, you know, with all other agencies, because time is critical, the economy is tough, we need to kind of save money is what my point is.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we can iron this out and have it ready to go for the 2012 session. I'll also inform Senator Beyer and Representative Holvey and Representative Wisnett and regarding this, because I think they'll also be looking at public contracting issues in a more with a broader brush. So thank you very much for your testimony,
you,
gentlemen. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. I think we will now, if it's okay with people who are here for public records, we have several people who would like to testify and get back to their day jobs who are not government employees or representatives of associations, and so I would like to give them the courtesy, and so I'd like to move to the next business The next order of business to be the small business lending, if that's okay. Keith, can you stick around? Okay. And is that all right with those who will be talking about public records? All right, good. Could we please bring up Lynn Schessler, Paul Grove, and Terry Hagel?
Morning, Mr. Chair.
Welcome,
members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lynn Schessler. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Business Development Department. Recognizing that we have some people that you would far more like to hear from than me, that being the small businesses that are here, that are their tail to tail, I'm going to be brief in my comments to you. I just want to emphasize that our department deals with the small business lending in two different ways. We have two direct lending programs. One is the Oregon Business Development Fund, and the other is the Entrepreneurial Development Fund. Terry Hagel is with us here today. He's a loan officer in those programs, and he has the details related to each one of those. Let me just say that the Oregon Business Development Fund is for businesses that are larger. It can loan up to $700,000, and it's a traded sector targeted program. The Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, on the other hand, is for startup companies. It's not got a big loan amount. It's $50,000, but we are amazed at the recent popularity of that program. In fact, that program has run out of money, and we've had to move money from our other programs into that one due to the demand that's evolving with small businesses getting started in these times, of all things. We do have a third program. It's the Industrial Development Bond Program. That's sizable bonding that we work with significant lenders on for companies that want to do $2 and $3 million expansions, if not more. The second way we approach the assistance to small businesses is through loan guarantees. We have a credit enhancement fund that essentially guarantees to a certain degree the borrowing of a conventional lender to a small business. And then we have a capital access program, which is, again, a partnership with local banks, where we match a reserve account that the bank deposits so that if there is a loss that they incur related to a loan to a small business, that loss is covered at least in part by our funds as well as the local bank's funds. One thing I did want to emphasize to you that we have been successful in our request for funding from the federal government, that being the U.S. Treasury. Some of you have may be heard about the Small Business Credit Initiative that we applied for. That was a $16.5 billion grant from the Treasury. We were successful with that, and we will put $10 million into the additional funds that are available for the guarantee program. We will expand the Business Development Fund by $2.5 million and have $4 million available for the Capital Access Program. With that, I will turn it over to Paul if you don't have any questions. And he has those businesses that are with us today that can tell their story about how these programs have benefited them.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with the Business Development Department. And we are fortunate today to have a couple of companies that we have worked with over the past year, in particular around the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Program that Deputy Director Schessler had pointed out. Our first company is Coastal Mountain Springs out of McMinnville, and James and Anthony Vandermeed will be here to tell their story in terms of the program and their company. And then we also have Jet Clothing from Portland, and Kristen Casperson and Jennifer Thomas have agreed to come and also speak to their company, the loan program, and their plans for the future as well.
Great. Bring them on up.
Excuse me, and first and foremost, it's going to be James and Anthony Vandermeed.
Chairman Shields, Vice Chairman George, and members of the committee. I'm Anthony Vandermeed, President of Coastal Mountain Springs. My brother James will also testify here. But thank you very much for the opportunity here to talk about our business and how the funds have actually helped us get this business started. Coastal Mountain Springs is a small family corporation. We incorporated back in 1999 with the intentions of bottling spring water We have a spring on our family farm, and we want to bring spring water to these, you know, with these 5-gallon and 3-gallon containers, you know, to the public. We're a local spring. Most of the spring water in our community comes from out of the local area, still within Oregon, but so we saw a need and a niche that we could fulfill by, you know, developing our spring and getting a bottling company going. Our goals are to have a fully social, economic, and environmentally sustainable business. From a social standpoint, we both have families in the community. We intend to, you know, support, you know sports programs and so forth, you know, as we can. And economic, since we are a local business, we have and certainly do intend to continue to use local businesses within our community as much as possible. I mean, some of the supplies we have to get out of state, but most of them are all local. Environmental, we designed our building so that we can, in the future, use, you know, solar power to do a lot of the, you know, meet some of our power requirements and so forth. Of course, we use all, you know, recyclable, you know, materials and so forth where we can, and we want to, you know, continue that through the future. So as we looked towards starting up this company, being, you know, not having a lot of resources within the family, we certainly looked towards many, many different areas, you know, for helping the startup. And that's where the Entrepreneurial Fund really kind of helped us get started. They gave us the loan so that we had the ability to get that little extra money we needed to build a facility, you know, and hire those contractors and so forth to get moving. My brother was instrumental in all that activity, so I'd like to actually turn it over to him to explain how we went through that process, how he came about to find that, and how it worked for us. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Shields and Vice Chair George and Honor Committee. My name is James Vandermeer. I'm the Vice President of our company. I'm Vice President in charge of production and all operations. I first started research and development in this company about 2 years ago. I first started going to the SBA and larger banks thinking that there was funds available for startup loans, but in my experience and with many, many large facilities, there is no funds available for starting small businesses such as ours. The requirements that they eventually told us that we needed were a 2-year successful track record or 100% liquid assets in the bank as collateral. Now, being a brand new business, we have no track record, and we did not have 100% of the liquid assets, so if I had these things, I would not be asking for a loan. I turned to many different places, called many different people, congressmen, state representatives, senators. Maybe some of you may have contacted before by me. I was eventually turned on to the Business Oregon program by Economic Fairness Oregon. It's a group that actually told me about the fund because it was kind of hard to locate at first. And then without this fund, we would not be in operation. We're opening next week. We hope to hire local employees very soon. It helped build a brand new building that was not there before. And the funds that we did receive are actually helping the community right now. We were able to hire local contractors, local supplies, pay local fees, local permits, and all that money is actually being used and revolving around the local economy right now. I feel that it's a great thing that we are getting extensions on these funds, and I fully encourage the federal government to actually put more into these programs, because as the state has a better knowledge than the federal government of what is needed in the local areas and has better they know what's going on. They really know what's needed in the area, and they know where to take the risks, and where they, as we're just looked at as numbers through the SBA, the larger banks, we're looked at a little bit better through the smaller state organizations. And I really thank Business Oregon for letting us have this fund, but like I said before, it's a crucial to starting small businesses here. There really is not any process right now that is good through the federal system that will qualify someone like us to start a small idea and let it go forward to help the community now. It's too long of a process, and through Business Oregon, we were able to shorten the process, shorten the time of startup. We were able to access funds easily. The requirements were a lot less strict than the federal process. And the only issue I see is, as they were saying before, is the lack of funds. There are so many people out there in the classes I was taking, all the programs I was taking, that have great ideas, that need these started, but the funds are running out. And it is a crucial key to keeping these brand new businesses going. And the newer the business, creating a business where one has not started before is not, like I said, not only helping create new jobs, but the money gets put right back into the economy immediately. It is used in a trickle effect. The contractors that were willing to work next week because they were lacking work this week were able to put up our building very quickly, and they'll probably be able to keep their mortgages to help their families through this winter where they would not be able to do that before. And I'm open for any questions, and I thank the committee for your time.
Could I ask you a couple of questions? So yeah. You went with the entrepreneurial fund, and that's the $50,000 max?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so tell me about the cost of that money as it would compare to the market rates. What kind of interest are you paying?
If I may.
If you could get a loan anywhere else.
I can't remember the interest rate off the top of my head, but it is extremely favorable looking at in our position. We were going to be looking at, you know, probably about 6% through banks and so forth, and it was a much, much better rate than that. I think it was like 3.5%. It was the rate that we had, and we borrowed $20,000 from that fund.
And when do you have to start paying on it?
We have started paying already. Yes.
And it's pretty much immediately you begin paying.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. You start paying the month after you receive the funds. So.
Did you have questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's really great to see both of you in here that help is not only on the way, but you actually found it. I think one of the things that we've thought a lot about is how to make it easier for small businesses to find out about the programs that the state has available, or even programs that you could apply for that we don't directly administer. And we've talked about, and I think in another hearing room, they're even having a hearing on doing a one-stop shop approach where small businesses could access all this information without having to hunt it down the way you did. And it's, you know, it is heartening that you found it, but it's a little distressing that it was a non-governmental organization that you went to after calling everybody you could think of, it sounds like. So I don't know if this is a question for the department or for you, but do you have comments about just how difficult that was and whether you've got any thoughts about how we could make it easier?
Yet, Chair Shields and Senator Rosenbaum, to answer your question, it was very difficult. There are no arrows pointing the way to find the money. To make it easier, maybe advertising through the state that there are the funds available, not really advertising, but letting, like you said, a one-stop shop where people can actually go and get access the information, access the different funds, to maybe get someone to point them in the right direction of who to talk to. Because there's so many people out there and so many organizations, you get lost in the shuffle. Everybody is willing to, especially large banks, larger organizations, to say that they're out there to help. But when it comes down to it, you'll never meet the criteria. And to find the funds in the state through a third organization, yes, I do believe that a site on the state, maybe websites or access information that is directed towards this, the actual startup businesses, would be a lot easier for us to find. And maybe also a little bit leniency on the collateral part of it. Some of us starting a new business have been hit by the bad economy. Our houses are not worth as much. We have not as much collateral as we used to have a couple of years ago where we thought we did. So we do not meet the criteria of high collateral where we could maybe get a larger loan to ease the process of putting in the new facilities, the new organizations, if the collateral part was maybe dropped down just a little bit so that we could qualify. Maybe if the state was willing to put up a slightly larger risk or was able to put up a larger risk, it would ease all our efforts.
Somebody once said the problem with poverty is there isn't any money in it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for coming and sharing your story. And I'm sorry if I missed that. How many people are working on the building, and how many people will you be employing?
If I may, thank you. We are currently, we've hired contractors to do all the work. The work has been done for the building. We have all of our equipment and so forth. We're ready, as my brother had stated, we're just waiting on the final Department of Agriculture approval to get which will be next week. So we put to work, to answer your question, I believe we had four different contractors. So there were, I think, a total of about eight or nine people who actually worked on the building during that process. Our plans are to employ within the next 3 to 5 years, 10 employees, full-time employees, delivery drivers and so forth to get our product out there in the market.
Thank you. And may I ask a follow-up?
Sure.
As well? I think this is more of a comment in response to Senator Rosenbaum's question. One of the things that I've done in the past is worked with my state representatives in my district and had a town hall meeting where Business Oregon came and did a presentation about what they do across the state, and it's really helpful to get all of that information out to our constituents. So that's something that you could do to help get the word out so that people can actually find the great programs that they're offering.
Senator Boquist. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, to your point, you know, the Internet is a wonderful thing, but Google is only so smart. And frankly, personal contact is what wins the day. And we do have regional business development officers, but we have a limited number of them. But to the degree they can make those personal contacts that link individuals with our programs, that's the success stories that are out there.
Senator Boquist.
Well, it's almost like we're back to deja vu on indefinite quantity contracts, because Oregon has a platform. We have a File Oregon webpage, which everybody has to go to register the business, so on and so forth. And so we have the first step to provide the information of what other things are out there. And I'm sure they've been on it, but of course it tells you how to go file. That's how to make some regulatory things. You know, and then if you do the Google and you find out the nightmares about the inspections that they have upcoming, you know, and they'll all have ulcers and need the Oregon medical plan here shortly. But having said that, there's also other methods. Senator George and I have met 3 or 4 times with the employment department on an overhaul of unemployment insurance. And you say, like, how in the world is this related to starting up a business? And what we have found out from the unemployment department is that if you become unemployed and suddenly say immediately, well, I should start my own business, you can actually use unemployment benefits to start your business. But if you don't say that the first time around, then you can't do it. Hmm. And our program is in huge need of overhaul. Senator Feinstein at the federal level, Democrat, of course, is, you know, proposing an overhaul of the federal system, because the state has said the federal system prevents us from doing these innovative things. Like, for example, they could go out and take people that are unemployed. Part of the initial wages could be subsidized by unemployment benefits that they're entitled to in order to help finance the business, which becomes collateral, which then makes the banks back there real nervous because now they have collateral and they might actually have to do something. So there's a whole circle here of things, and I would encourage, you know, the committee, Mr. Chair, that, you know, we start talking about small business lending. I mean, the whole unemployment insurance and the whole federal integration is something that we should look at, because we are really prohibited in the state of Oregon of some of the innovative things that could be done to help small businesses and startups. And when you look at the numbers from the employment department, the number of people who are getting unemployed and then instantly decide that first day, because they have to make the choice then, that, hey, I want to start my own business, it is pretty phenomenal. And since 40% of all businesses that are out there, unfortunately come and cycle around, it's small business that creates jobs literally out there. Yeah. So I would encourage us to kind of maybe drag the employment department into this whole thing, so that we can get on board with the federal legislation as soon as possible, so that we can actually, when we start creating jobs, real job creation, that we can use all the financial assets that are out there.
Yeah. Thank you. And if you all would like to make that a topic of a future hearing.
Just raised as a topic, and I'd love to have a hearing for it. And the Department of Employment would love to. They've been to meet Senator George and I several times, and we've had the community colleges in it. And, you know, how do you craft a program? And it's always, well, we've got to get a federal waiver. Well, now we have senators, both Democrat and Republican, at the federal level saying, hey, we need to make the system more flexible so that those unemployment benefits can, in fact, be used to help start up businesses.
All right, good. Thank you very much.
If I may, Chair, I have to elaborate on that. The people I met in the Chemeketa classes were people that were out of work. They did make that decision right off the bat. They wanted to go out and create jobs like we were told by our president and everybody else. We're out of work. We have time on our hands. And the restrictions by the employment agency for that do prevent it. You have to feed your family also. You have to make sure that you have income. You can't go spend months and months and months creating something brand new and not be able to pay your mortgage, to feed your kids, to make sure you have insurance. So you're forced into other alternatives. They're not starting a business, not creating a job. They're out finding a common job, a flipping burgers, pumping gas, something that will feed my family now. And to ease that transition is a great idea, and it would help so many people in the program right now that are put in that position, that hardship position, where it's very difficult for them to do two things at once.
Mm-hmm. Good. And I think I'd mentioned another committee when I was calling in payroll in my day job. ADP was mentioning one of the federal tax breaks for COBRA or hiring a new employee or something, and I thought that was a pretty innovative way to get the message across, and that might be something the Business Development Department thinks about, too, on some of its other programs where there are tax credits for hiring people to see if they can get paychecks or ADP to help spread the word somehow to their customers. All right. Great. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Best of luck, and we wish you good luck and Godspeed.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Can we bring up the people from Jet Clothing?
Hello. Can I pass out something?
Yeah, please. Give it to the committee administrator.
No.
They haven't started bottling yet. Wait till they get over to, wait till Katie kills in the inspection. I have nightmares over that one. Not her fault. She's trying to follow federal law, but.
First, we're just going to say hello and just show you that we make clothes. Some dresses. Everything that we're wearing right now.
Oh, yeah. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
I'm Kristen Casperson.
And I'm Jennifer Thomas, and we're of Jet Clothing.
Thank you. And then we're not going to be able to get you on what you say on the record without being near the microphone. Also.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. Okay, well, you saw that we make clothes. So. We're wearing them, and that's what we do. Pardon me, public speaking. Ew.
You're doing fine.
So from what we can gather here, you guys are really interested in creating jobs, and that is at the top of what we do every day. Our business runs with the basic principle of supply and demand. We're doing what most small businesses are doing to stay relevant. We are we're building it because people want it, and then we're hiring people to help us build it. A equals B. While we have a business plan and goals, we also want to be flexible enough to respond to our market. So along that lines, we are a sustainable company. That's a buzzword right now. But what that means to us is that we don't waste in spending materials or time. We just simply don't have the resources to waste. We could elaborate on what green is, but we basically we concentrate on using sustainable materials, soy, organic cotton, bamboo, things that can be easily replaced in the world. And it also comes down to choices, daily choices. One of the topics of our sustainability is is people that work for us and with us and how to sustain our lives and families around that. Let's see, where was I? So kind of what we did is we started out with working together at a fashion show, Kristen and I, and I had clothing. I started it in my attic, and I'm basically a native Oregonian, raised in the apple orchards with my grandparents, and didn't know that I was getting into business. Didn't know that that's what I wanted to do, and ended up partnering with Kristen and realizing the dream of having a clothing line. But then when we got there, we found that we weren't sure how to approach people with this new sustainability action. A lot of people know about it, but a lot of people don't know why you need to walk into a clothing store and pay $100 more for something than you would at Walmart. And that's because of local production, local jobs, producing those things, and the materials that we use being sustainable and more expensive because of that. Water-based dyes and all of those things that are a little bit more expensive. So we're just taking you through this little packet that we've passed out.
So as Jennifer said, we partnered up. I had a current business, and we leveraged that business. I was working with the Small Business Development Center when we... soon after we opened the store, we realized we needed more revenue. We were really working on a shoestring budget, and having worked with the Small Business Development Center, they put me in touch with Business Oregon, and we worked through the loan process to get the $25,000 loan to basically buy materials so that we could continue on producing garments on a larger scale. And Business Oregon was really great and to work with. They were very helpful. They made the process really smooth, actually. And we're at the point now in our business where we're ready to take it to the next level. And so we're going to hopefully partner up with them again to help us do that. Along the timeline, we founded JET in 2009. In August 2009, we opened a store in North Portland on Mississippi. September 2010 is when we got the loan from Business Oregon. March 2011, we made the leap of hiring a production manager. And in that same month, we got a call from one of our, what we consider to be the premier department store, Barney's New York, called it and from New York. Well, you should say this because you were there. You
took the phone call. It was a Saturday, and I was at the store, as I typically am on Saturdays. I said, "Good afternoon, JET Clothing." And he said, "Is this JET Clothing, like the sustainable clothing company in Portland, Oregon?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And he said, "Well, I have a customer here requesting your wares. Is there anywhere that it's for sale in the city?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "No, it's only for sale in Portland, Oregon at this point." Sure. And so we just had a little conversation about how I was the designer and everybody's, you know, it's a small thing. I'm answering the phone on a Saturday. And he says, "Well, this is fantastic." It was a great little call.
Yeah, it was a feather in our cap for sure. Mm-hmm. So then moving along, we worked with some local production companies and found that the timeline and there was issues associated with that. And we just decided to bring it in-house. So we hired our first dedicated sewer, and in April the same month, we delivered our first full wholesale order. Now in July of 2011, we just moved into a 2,000-square-foot production facility, which we call the Hangar. And currently, to date, we have 10 employees, and our goal in the next few months is to go full more with wholesale and create more jobs and move forward with that.
Can I ask you a question? Is all the production happening on Mississippi?
Yes.
Our production facility ended up being right down the street from our store. We made a connection with a great landlord, and it just sort of was a kismet situation where it was two blocks down the way, so we actually get to walk the items up to the store and sell them right there. It's something our customers appreciate.
And on the second page, I broke down our sales, and I broke it out by our retail sales, overall as a store, and then below that is the Jet Apparel sales breakout. And you can see that we've increased our Jet Apparel sales to retail sales from less than 50% to 65% of our store sales in the last, from 2010 to 2011. And you can see where we got the loan from Business Oregon. It's where it started increasing the actual apparel sales. It's amazing when you've got product to sell.
Yeah, one interesting thing we noticed is that, you know, there are some months where we made maybe $4,000 or $5,000, and then the next month we'd make $10,000 or $12,000. And that's because what would happen is we would contract out this production, and then we would get it in the store, and it would sell, and then we would be sitting there like, well, we have this little tiny thing to sell, you know, and so then we would get the fabric and do it again. But just that process of getting enough fabric and enough product out, it's a good problem to have, but it's also where we need more money, mm-hmm. which is why we'll go back and talk to them again.
And then just some interesting facts. For the Sorayan organic cotton, for 100 yards, it's $700. And the average number of garments we can produce out of that is roughly 60. To date, we've sold 320 pairs of our leggings at $68 each. That's about $20,000. And to date, we've sold 203 pocket dresses for $148 each, and that's about $30,000 just for those two items. And our payroll tax is estimated for this year is about $23,000, which is painful.
That leaves me. Yeah.
It makes it challenging to hire more people and then get that payroll tax bill at the end of the quarter.
It is, and that's one of the things that we actually wanted to bring to your attention while we were here and had a minute of your time to talk to people who can affect this. We feel that we are affecting things on a very grassroots level, but to talk to our representatives and actually make you aware of the fact that we're trying to be profitable, we're providing jobs, but our biggest challenges are payroll taxes, health insurance, and spending capital. We have some really strong aspects of our company, and we are all working our high knees off to make this thing happen, and it's working. But when we get a $25,000 loan from Business Oregon, and then the next year we pay $23,000 in payroll taxes, it kind of doesn't add up for moving forward as quickly and as easily as we want to.
Well, my assumption is the bulk of those are federal FICA Social Security taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe President Obama has a plan at the federal level to give you a break on that.
Really?
Yes.
Good.
In support of
1%.
How much was it?
1.2%. Break.
Wow.
Get a mocha.
Great.
I have a lot of employees, so mine's a lot higher than yours. I think Senator George is higher. We feel your pain. Definitely feel your pain.
Yeah. We're completely open to any suggestions about how to get that number down for ourselves, but right now that's one of our roadblocks. That and health insurance. Most of our employees work around 30 hours a week. We work maybe double that at least a week, but we still can't afford health insurance for our company at all. Listening to the gentleman that was up here before saying that he wants to provide, you know, he's talking about the problem of providing a living wage for his family and putting a roof over his kids' heads and insurance. I'm a mom. I'm a single mom. Basically, just to do this business, we have we've done without, and we've seen that it is something that we really believe in and that we really want to do. And it's funny because I didn't think that when I was a little girl that clothing could affect people's lives. I was actually in college to be a doctor, and I felt like art was sort of something that I loved to do, but it was never going to really make the difference. And I feel that we are making a difference at this point, and it's a really good feeling at the end of the day.
And so can I ask you a couple of questions about your concerns about insurance?
Yes.
Are you both going without health insurance right now, or are you buying in the individual market?
I am not able to have individual insurance because of a pre-existing condition that was an accident, an acupuncture accident, which is kind of strange, but insurance just works the way it works. And so, no, I don't have health insurance. My daughter has health insurance, so that's good.
I have health insurance through my husband.
Well, one of the things that this committee has worked on is trying to address the exponential growth in premiums in the individual and small group markets by making health insurance companies justify their premiums in a more public forum. And we've made some advances in that, but I'll be happy to keep you posted on that, because that is what we hear time in and time out. One of the major reasons why people can't hire is because they can't afford health insurance. Mm-hmm. Or why they're not jumping out into the marketplace in the first place, because they're not willing to jeopardize. They're willing to jeopardize their own health sometimes, but not necessarily the health of their children mm-hmm. when they have a decent plan from their employer.
Absolutely.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Yeah, just a quick comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a question for you. And I love your story. I really love your story, because it is so hard to find clothing made in the United States anymore, let alone in Oregon. And so it's just really heartening to see companies like yours, and there are quite a few that have sprung up to mm-hmm. manufacture locally, since major Oregon companies like Pendleton, that used to make everything here, have largely offshored all of that work. I think except for you know, blankets and men's shirts, I think everything they sell is now made in some other country, and that's really tragic if you try to spend your money to help people locally. What I wanted to ask you about was kind of the same question I asked earlier, because you talked about the small business development centers, which I know are a great resource, but I'm curious, how did you find out that they even existed? How did you get in touch with the resources that you were able to tap into?
I have a store also in Hood River, and I started working with the Small Business Development Center at the community college there. There was
community
college. Yeah, at Columbia Gorge Community College, and they were the ones that put me in touch with the Small Business Development Center. They are aware of, I guess, you know, more programs that are out there. Like the gentleman before, we looked at other sources of funding as well, and it was really prohibitive. They require a lot of collateral, or you have to be employed and self-employed for 2 years. I mean, there's just, you know, too many hoops to jump through, and so it was a great resource.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, you mentioned that you've got 10 employees mm-hmm. now. How does that break down between the retail location and the production?
Right now we've got one pseudo full-time 32-hour retail person, and then Jennifer and I cover, and we've got one very part-time person. The retail store tends to be a little bit more in flux. People move in and out of the retail position a lot quicker. So ideally we would have two part-time people, and then we cover.
Yeah, and then we have one director of marketing that helps with all of the social media and all this kind of stuff, and then the rest of it is our production team. We have a production manager, which is our hugest expense, but absolutely is a position that drives our company, and so we felt that it was necessary to get somebody good in there and to sacrifice, mm-hmm. maybe pay them more than ourselves. and then the rest are sewers and production assistants. What kind of happens at the end of the day is you can cut like a whole stack of shirts out, but then sewing them takes more time and skill, so we have more sewers than production assistants.
And I know I said that was the last question. This really is. Your internet sales, it looks like in your business plan you're trying to grow the business through the internet. Is that a bigger source of sales for you than the retail location? Or
no. Not currently. No, we'd love to make that, because it's much less expensive.
Given the choice of how to spend the money when we got the money, one of the options was to create a full-blown website, but we figured if we had this great website and no product, we would be shooting ourselves in the foot, so we put the money into materials.
Mm-hmm. And we got a template website.
Yeah.
Made that work.
But apparently that's the trend now anyway, so we're probably glad we didn't spend $10,000 on a website when you can do it a lot more cost-effectively, and actually a lot of it in-house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Senator Boquist.
Just a comment for that next hearing we're going to have. I think you've heard the theme here. You community college, you heard it in the first testimony. Community college, you heard it in the second testimony. And then, you know, you have Business Oregon, and now what we're going to do is wrap the regulatory portion into it and the employment department into this so that we get more of a synchronized plan, because we're going to have to create our own jobs. We can chase all the Nikes in the world, but they're producing clothes overseas too, and it doesn't do us any good.
No, that's absolutely right, and it all kind of goes together. I mean, what our economy has been living on for the last 10, maybe 15, 20 years is real estate finance and home construction, and when that blew up, we realized we've shipped all of our jobs overseas. So your point's very well taken.
In fact, there might be
a Senate memorial in 2002 to address that.
We're going to have to pull ourselves up, Mr. Chair, which means, you know, we're going to have to use combine all of our resources together without spending more and spend it more wisely so we can help people like this create jobs.
That's right. You don't make hazelnut wear, do you? Senator George is a hazelnut producer.
Hey, my staff made hazelnut soap the other day, so be careful about when we start talking about artistic stuff. You can do it with hazelnuts.
Well, that is one question I think about periodically. What would happen if we couldn't get resources from China? Because currently our fabrics are still being run through Turkey and China and all over the world. We have wool in Oregon, but we can't wear wool all the time. So maybe hazelnuts, we can do that. Yeah. Combine
pine nuts into
cotton.
This too, okay? And my junipers.
Well, we appreciate the work that you're doing, and we're very glad that the Business Development Department was able to be such a good partner
Thank
for you. My wife and I live not far away from your store, and we'll be sure to frequent it.
I was going to invite you, and you as well, and you as well, and you as well, all of you. Yeah, stop on by. We're going to have a party. It's October 7th, and it's in our production facility, and it's for our second year anniversary. So you're all invited. You can find it on the website.
That's great. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right, and for the Business Development Department, is that all the testimony we have? Great. Well, thank you very much for your work to the companies that testified. Thanks for coming and taking time out from making a living to share your story. It's very much appreciated.
Thank you.
Best wishes in that. All right, I'd like to now dive into the non-controversial topic of public records law. And why don't we bring up Keith and Michael Cron first, and then we'll bring up the counties and cities after that. And if I could just tee this up, the reason why I wanted to get this on the agenda, I think there were some very ambitious efforts last time around. I think we were hopeful that when we passed this through our committee that common ground could be found as it moved to another committee, to the Rules Committee, and unfortunately that common ground was never found. But I wanted to send a very clear message to the parties that are involved, state agencies, as well as municipal governments, that this is an important issue to this body, and it's one we would like to continue to take up and most likely, hopefully, have some progress to be made. I'm thinking most likely in 2013 as opposed to 2012. So with that being said, I'll hand it over and welcome back to the committee, Mr. Dubanovich.
Good morning, Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, members of the committee. My name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm Chief of Staff at the Department of Justice and Special Counsel to the Attorney General. The Attorney General remains committed to more transparent government and to the set of ideas that were proposed in Senate Bill 41. Given the complexity of the issues that were involved in that bill and the need for you to be focusing on budgetary matters and on the governor's priorities in 2012, we would suggest that this issue be deferred until 2013. But, of course, if you want to look at the issue in the interim or bring something up in 2012, we would be pleased to work with you and with any other interested parties. In addition, we would suggest that we disaggregate the issues that were combined into Senate Bill 41. In retrospect, we believe that the complexity of that bill was one of the challenges that we faced in the 2011 general session. So rather than combine them all into one bill, we think that separate bills might be easier to digest and deal with. And finally, let me reiterate that we appreciated all of the input that we did receive. We certainly were moving in the right direction, and we look forward to working with everyone on this important issue.
Senator Boquist.
Boy, that's well spoken, Keith. Offline, I'd be most interested, you know, to meet with you and come up with a list of the sticks in the mud. I mean, I'm disappointed we didn't go forward. I think when we go into the February session, we're going to face serious budget cuts again, and we're going to have entities that, you know, should have been cooperating, you know, in public access, public transparency. They're going to pay the price. And as I've said here clearly before, I think we're going to see a serious downsizing in government simply because whether the economy right-sizes, things aren't going to be good at all. And there are some entities that fiercely, none of them, I will say, that are on the testimony list here, that fiercely opposed, you know, going forward with, you know, a revamp of access to public records. And some of those entities may find themselves, you know, left out of discussions. And, you know, we're going to have some serious merging of government here coming up in front of us. You know, it just irritates me, Mr. Chair, that, you know, there were people who blocked an effort that is long overdue. And, you know, the AG's office and others and even some of the people who are going to come up and tell us that there are problems with the proposal that was put forward with SB 41. But, you know, the cities and the counties, you know, weren't, frankly, the major problems. They have some problem deals, and everybody needs to have something put together that kind of fits them. But our laws, frankly, are terrible. And if we don't know what's going on and we don't have access, the largest complaints I have in my office on a routine basis are school districts. And education is going to face some serious challenges here in the next 2 to 4 years. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Boquist. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, just briefly, yeah. Thank you. And Keith, I share your frustration, believe me, since I inherited this bill after it left this committee. It came to the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
But I was curious about your suggestion of separating the issues, because it seems like, just what I remember, the areas were sort of the whole effort to revamp the exemptions, what is subject to public disclosure, was one whole area of discussion. And then there was the issues around deadlines for production of those records and charges for them. Are there other issues, like big areas that need to be addressed, or were those the big ones?
Chair Shields, Senator Rosenbaum, I think you've identified the key areas. One thing that we did learn along the way is that there is substantial variation in governmental entities. You know, there are some governmental entities that have a part-time employee, and we need to be extraordinarily mindful of the difficulties that they challenge. And so I think along the way, we're going to have to recognize that a one-size-fits-all solution may not be the best solution.
Just a final comment, Mr. Chair. That I think, really hits the nail on the head, because what's so challenging about addressing this right now is at a time of just complete budget austerity, although I think everybody would agree that more disclosure and accountability and a streamlined process is where we want to go. It's also hard sometimes to figure out how to implement that at the same time that the agencies that have to deal with it have fewer people to physically do what needs to be done. So I think that may be part of why this became so challenging, in addition to just the complexity of it.
Mr. Chair. I think there's a third area, and that's consolidation. And that's, I think, one of the biggest challenges we face, and to what Senator Rosenbaum is saying here, if we simply went into the code like we attempted to do last time and put it all in the same chapter so that there's one list and one standard, but instead what we're doing to the issue of finances is that these public records laws, I mean, 2 years in judiciary, I mean, they're all over the place. I mean, they're hidden here, they're hidden there, they're there. You have no idea what they are, and therefore every agency is doing rulemaking, setting standards, having people manage the program, so on and so forth. So instead of having, you know, dedicated, you know, state employees doing what they ought to be doing, they're all dealing with their own set of little rules here in 200 different agencies. And that consolidation is probably the fundamental cost savings that can be driven out of this, is to put it all in one chapter and says, here's the set of rules. Agency that has a half-time employee doesn't have to go do its own, set its own rules. That agency can go out and do what it's supposed to be doing instead. And so I think there's really a third part, and it's probably the single largest cost saving, is that consolidation piece, to get all the statutes in one set, one chapter, one list, so that there's one, if there's two or three standards based on size, it's fine, but then there's one set of standards, so that, you know, the agency that has two employees, that's the, you know, the board of pharmacy or something, doesn't have to go do its own rulemaking and do its all own stuff. It would save a tremendous amount of money and then give those smaller agencies the ability to do their mission.
Well said. Thank you, Keith. Can we bring up, let's see, Scott Winkles from the League of Oregon Cities and Mike Eliason from the Association of Oregon Counties. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Shields, Vice Chair George, for the record, I'm Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. It was my understanding you wanted an update of where we were with the public records process, and I will tell you the League has certainly not been idle on the topic. Some of the public associations and media interests have been conversing somewhat regularly, and we are in the process of collecting all of the training materials that are out there on public records to ensure the solid compliance with the current statute. The League has agreed to act as a clearinghouse, if you will, of those training materials. And once we get them all collected, and I was surprised at the number that are out there, and we can make sure that they're all correct. Sometimes that does happen, that someone misreads something. We're possibly looking at distilling some of that down into a simple, but not simplistic format that can be distributed to the a public official who needs a basic understanding of the public record statute. You couldn't do a one size fits all for training, because a city recorder, a manager, city attorney, their training on the matter needs to be far more robust, and we offer a 6-hour course in it. If any would like to attend, I can arrange that. Additionally, the League believes that there is a way we can reduce the time, complexity, and some of the costs now in dealing with public records requests, and that would be to take that catalog of exemptions that was in Senate Bill 41 and simply place that in the public records manual. We think that would, there's no need for legislation to do that, and there's no risk of jeopardizing existing case law. Many of these exemptions have been litigated. They're settled law on it. There were some concern with the manner in which it was done in 41, where that case law could have been disrupted and we'd have to, and things would be relitigated. The attorney to my right may go into that in more detail, but that would make the life simpler for the requester, for the agency, for media interests, and for the public in general. The list of exemptions is not an efficient way. We have not done this efficiently. I believe Mr. Crone cataloged 455 exemptions in the public record statute, only 55 of those exemptions actually appear in the public record statute. So what happens on a city level is a person will come into a city and say, I want the disciplinary record of a police officer who gave me a ticket or something, and they have a copy of the public record statute with them. And the recorder says, I'm sorry, that's exempt. And they says, no, there's the exemptions right here. And says, well, yes, but if you have the entire set of ORS chapters and go four volumes down, you will see in 181 it's clearly exempted. It creates a trust in government issue, and that doesn't need to be there. So we think consolidating these in the manual is something that could be done now that would make, again, life simpler for all parties. And with that, that's sort of what we've been doing on the public records issue for now. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Eliason.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, Mike Eliason with the Association of Oregon Counties.
Mr. Winkles is already hit on most of the points I was going to cover, but also I'll be brief. We also have been part of those discussions as far as trying to accumulate all the different training materials, put together sort of a one consistent best practices in public records that we can make sure that we get out to our people. We've been going through trying to step up our training of new commissioners. You know, every 2 years there's a number of new commissioners that come through, stepping up our training of county councils to make sure they're familiar with the current law. And I think there's maybe at some point there was a little bit of forgetting that we went through a fairly significant rewrite of public records law two regular sessions ago. We added a number of extra processes to the records process as far as making counties or making all governments provide a list of how who at the government agency is responsible for responding to requests, who a timeline, or basically if you can't respond right away, give an estimate of how long it's going to take. A schedule of how fees are calculated. So a number of things were done in 2007, and we wonder if the problem is with the law or if there are people who maybe don't understand the law as it is now, and that's where the education process comes in. I'm trying to make sure people understand what the current law is. As far as the exemptions, we do agree that one simple way to address them might be to put that cataloging of the 450-odd exemptions into the manual. There is one of the issues, I think, during the session was the original bill, Senate Bill 41, sort of added new preambles to some of these new sections that cataloged the exemptions, and there was some question on whether that would change the existing case law. So with that, we do agree that that might be the proper place, is not doing it through a legislative process, but putting it in the manual. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
So what I hear you saying is that would be your preference, is to not even engage in continual improvement in the legislative statutes of this, or do you think this can be all done offline?
Senator Shields, Chair Shields, members of the committee, I can recall no instance where the League has declined participation in a work group or in a conversation. The purpose of the presentation was to say where we are now. Okay. If you wish to have a conversation about improving the statutes, we're willing to participate in that conversation. We would also encourage the committee to include the Secretary of State's office and the State Archivist, who is very active in both training and how to in the public record statute and in preservation of those documents as well.
And just to follow up, Chair Shields, I don't believe at any time we would turn down the opportunity to work on public records. In fact, to some extent, we were sort of expecting a work group to take place leading up to the introduction of the bill last session. So with that, at no time would we ever turn down an opportunity.
If I may expand on my previous comment, we requested such a work group prior to the introduction of the Senate Bill 41 companion measure in the House back in the summer. We anticipated such a work group to perform. We offered our willingness to participate in that. That offer has not been rescinded.
Senator Bocas.
Hey, Mr. Chair, what I think I heard is I heard the cities and counties saying they're trying to improve their existing process. Mm-hmm. And this whole process is going forward because they're addressing the city issues, they're addressing the county issues, but we have, I don't know, 200 some odd agencies out there, plus everybody else, that aren't part of this little microcosm of solution that they're working on temporarily. And I would anticipate, because 2012, 30 days is going to be rather blood-curdling, that the next session is when we need to see a fairly substantial overhaul. Overall, is probably not the right. Consolidation and clarity is what it is, without changing existing precedents, but to make it much easier, much more streamlined, especially at the state level. So all the state level agencies are on the same sheet of music. It's economical, and our public servants can be doing what they need to focus on instead of, dilly-dallying with, making their own agency rules up.
Thank you. So if looking back at the at Senate Bill 41, correct me if I'm wrong, but there were essentially three elements. One was the time frame in which a government entity needed to respond. Two was the cost and remuneration of that response. And then the third was the consolidation into one section of the statute. Were there other concerns or other elements of the bill, or was that the heart of it as you understood them?
Chair Shields, there were elements of the bill we quite liked, actually, that you didn't list off. There was the there was some protection against the from local governments for the harassing complaint, the harassing request, because occasionally it does happen that a person will request a document from a local government with no intention of ever picking it up, and simply to because they're angry about something. So the ability to seek a down payment or to not have to honor a request for a person who has an outstanding bill, that was certainly something we liked to the bill. There were, but I think that was, I think you encapsulated it reasonably well.
The big issues.
And Mr. Chair, just to point out the complexity of this entire issue, as you'll recall during testimony, we had people come up and say, well, why should the district attorney be involved in this process or that process and so on and so forth? And it's like, this red book right here says he's already involved in it. You didn't know that? Because it's so complex and it's scattered over, you know, I don't know, thousands of pages that are sitting here on the table that nobody really clearly knows all the stuff that's out there. And that's why I think, you know, a consolidation that doesn't change existing case law, as Counselor said, is, you know, almost the first clarification step. What is the problem? We don't know what it is because we... And Senator Rosenbaum wasn't here, but that was huge. I mean, just trying to understand the consolidation piece of it and read it was difficult.
Yeah. Well, the main thing that I wanted to express is the intention of the chair, and I think I speak for the committee members, that this is not a topic that we want to let slip by us, and that it's something that we do want to take into account for the next legislative session, the next full legislative session in 2013. And so we appreciate you coming forward and kind of updating us where things have gone since then. I don't know if this committee will lead a work group, but I hope that between now and 2013 that a work group develops either through the Attorney General's office, if it needs to be our committee that brings people together. I'm certainly willing to take that on, but at least for today, I wanted to at least send the message throughout the building that this is something that we all agree is important. It's not going away.
Okay, Mr. I would be supportive of asking that a work group either led by the AG's office or somebody go forth, and if they don't slay dragons in the next 6 months, we do it ourselves.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. Why don't we'll come back and have some discussion about that during the 2012 session. How's that sound? All right, anything else? Okay, that is all we have, correct? So, colleagues, I appreciate you hanging in there, and this meeting is adjourned.
The meeting is adjourned.